This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Our topic today is prostate cancer. My guest is Dr. Robert Allen. He's a urologist with the Alaska Urological Associates. Their office is on the Alaska Regional Campus in the Plaza Building. He's also a member of the American Urological Association. Each year, for several years, they've been having a free prostate screening. That's coming up in September. I'm going to go ahead and mention some dates and ways to find out more about this so I don't forget. A hotline to call and get some information about times and places, 276-1474, 276-1474, or you can go to Alaska Urology, akurology.com on the internet. Free screenings are in September, the week of September 21st. But call 276-1474 or go to akurology, all one word, .com if you want to get more information. Dr. Allen, welcome back to Line One.
Thanks for having me here, Thad.
All right, let's do the basics again. Tell me about that thing called the prostate gland. What's its purpose? Where is it? What's its structure? I don't know if we've talked about structure of the prostate gland.
Prostate gland is a little walnut-sized gland located at the base of the urinary bladder. Its function, other than to cause certain men problems when they get to be a certain age, is to produce the fluids that are necessary for sexual reproduction and ejaculation. It produces a nutrient-rich fluid that is used by the sperm to be transported during reproduction. The other function of the prostate and this is variable, is with age it will cause varying type of problems, which we'll discuss.
So let's discuss that now. Is it gets with age it gets what we call hypertrophied? Is that the right term for this? And then may cause obstructive symptoms? Is that what you're getting at?
What we've tried to do is simplify the language. We used to call it benign prostatic hyperplasia, hypertrophy. Those two words were used interchangeably. What we're trying to do now is call it benign prostatic enlargement. And then you say, well, how do we know it's benign? How do we know it's not malignant? And that's what we're going to discuss today, all these various ways to try to understand what might be going on with the prostate. Because many times somebody's going to come into the clinic, they're going to say, well, gee, doc, I don't have any problems whatsoever. It's just this number somebody found, and then we find that they do indeed have a prostate cancer.
Let me just ask you. I know about structure. I know it's difficult without pictures and doing this on the radio, and I don't think of the prostate as having a very sophisticated kind of structure. But tell us a little bit about what's going on inside that gland.
Well, again, as you stated, it's difficult to talk with on the radio, but speaking of sophisticated, your listeners can go to the internet and they can go to the various websites. And if you just Google prostate, then you can get some diagrams. But basically, again, it's a walnut-sized, normally, when it's not enlarged, organ that is situated under the bladder. It's composed of various regions that have various functions and have various consequences pathologically. For instance, the two main zones that we deal with, one is inside the other. We have the transitional zone that is a zone within the prostate that with age tends to get bigger, causing men their symptoms that of frequency and poor stream. There's the outer zone or the peripheral zone that tends to be where the cancers grow. That's why, and again, I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself, whenever you go to see the urologist or your primary care doctor for a screen, when they do the examination with the finger, the digital rectal examination, they will feel the back of your prostate through the rectal wall because that's very thin and that's where we can feel the prostate. And what we're feeling for is any abnormality or nodules or change in one side compared to the other that might cause us to be suspicious that there is either an enlargement or a tumor that needs to be further evaluated.
I would have guessed, if someone would ask me, that the prostate cancers develop in the more internal part of the prostate, assuming that that's where more of actual turnover of cells and things is more greater. But you're saying it's on the outside.
The peripheral zone, yes.
Huh.
There can, you know, these are generalizations.
Yeah,
certainly,
sure. Yeah.
There can be cancers forming in other parts of the prostate. And again, we're talking specifically about the most common cause of prostate adenocarcinomas. There are some other, which are 95 to 98% of the tissue type. There can be sarcomas. There can be epithelioid tumors. There can even be transitional cancers. But when we talk about prostate cancer, we're talking about adenocarcinomas.
So to clarify that last issue you brought up, within any structure in the body, there are multiple cell types, one of which may potentially develop cancer. In prostate, it's mainly the glandular tissue, which is the adenocarcinoma.
That's correct. There's glandular tissue. There's support tissue or stromal tissue. There's vascular tissue. So, you know, you can even find somebody might present with a prostate mass, and it could even be a lymphoma, so to speak. But again, mm-hmm. that's getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. I think what we're talking about is a garden variety adenocarcinoma in the prostate.
Okay. Just trying to satisfy my own curiosity, a little editorial stuff. All right. Let's talk about the symptoms then of prostate disorders. You've mentioned a little bit of the kind of symptoms, but let's go into it a little bit more.
We won't divide it. We'll just talk about symptoms that might be attributable to the prostate. Mm-hmm. Generally, there will be problems or a change in urination. Somebody might say, well, you know, gee, I used to not have to get up at night, and I have to get up once or twice or even more now. And that might become progressively worse, or it might stay the same. Some people might complain of a poor urinary stream. Whenever we have somebody come in for a prostate screen, whether we're concerned about regular old benign prostatic enlargement or BPH, we give them a score sheet. It's the AUA symptom score sheet, and that's seven questions that we try to quantitate with objective measurements, subjective type of symptoms, such as how many times do you get it tonight to go, how frequent do you go, how do you feel like you empty your bladder. Those are the type of things we try to quantify so that we can get a better idea and translate somebody's symptoms into something that's more reproducible, that we can better get a handle on how severe their symptoms are for them.
Are there different symptoms for prostate cancer? And particularly what I'm trying to get at is there something that really should alert a man that this is more than just benign hypertrophy?
You know, that's a good question, and the answer is no. You really can't distinguish the prostate cancer from the benign symptoms because, as I stated before, quite frequently somebody will come in with no symptoms at all, and they will have been picked up on just a routine physical examination, a screen, or a blood test that they have gotten at the health fair. So that's the concern, and this is – and again, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. We'll talk about this, but this is why we believe in screening for prostate cancer.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. My guest today is Robert Allen, a urologist here locally. And if you've got questions about prostate cancer, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. You can call us locally on 550-8433. 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at KSKA.org. You can do that between 2 and just before 3 o'clock today. If you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. So when we talk about cancer, we've talked about it a number of times on the program, but I still think sometimes the listening public may think of cancer as one kind of thing. And I'd like to talk about the fact that prostate cancers are not even all alike. They're not certainly like breast cancers or colon cancers, but they can even act a little differently.
That's a good point. Prostate cancer can act differently. You can have the same sort of cancer in one man that it behaves a little bit differently in another. I mean, generally, they will act the same, but sometimes there will be an exception, and this is why we have to individualize treatments. Oftentimes in studies, they'll talk about cohorts. Today, I'm going to talk about the individual and what we do with them. Briefly, what we do is factor in the following to try to get an idea of the aggressiveness of the prostate cancer. We take the patient's PSA blood test level, which is prostate-specific antigen. It's a simple blood test. And I need to mention that that's done through the vein. A lot of guys, the arm blood draw, a lot of guys think that you have to go in with a needle into the prostate to get that blood sample, and that's not true. So I want to dispel that notion. This is, I've talked to a number of people, and they say, gee, doc, if I'd have known that you were going to take the blood through the arm, I'd have been in here sooner. So I want everybody to understand that. It's not a fancy blood test. It's just you can get the blood test taken when you get your cholesterol taken. It's the same sort of thing. You don't need to be fasting, though. So anyway, we look at the PSA blood test, and then we, if we do a biopsy, and I'll talk about that, we look at the type of the cancer has certain characteristics under the microscope, and we call those Gleason scores, and that's how aggressive, angry, or what the cell types look like. And then with the combination of the blood test and the Gleason score, we can come up with somewhat of an idea of the aggressiveness of the cancer. Other ancillary tests would include CAT scans, possibly and bone scans, possibly MRIs in some of those more difficult cases. So I know I've just said a whole lot, and I'll have you, Thad, just try to distill that so we can talk about those one by one.
All right. Yeah, I want to talk about what we're discussing about aggressiveness, but I think what I'm going to do is we have a caller who's called in. I want to take his phone call. Then we'll come back to this idea about differences and what does a PSA tell us and the Gleason, and then what are the current things that physicians can use now to try to predict how a cancer is going to act. But let's do Rick's call first. Rick, you're on line one.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm curious about if there's been, you know, recent developments with PSA screenings because my sort of impression over the past few or to several years is that the PSAs might show, you know, sort of a high number, but it's a relative number and varies quite a bit with individuals. And so a high number may not necessarily be indicative of a cancer, but just maybe that individual's. So I'm just wondering if there's a way to balance that out. To try and determine, you know, the difference between the benign versus a potential for cancer.
All right, so this is a very important part of this program, and you've gotten to it directly. So let's talk about PSAs and what they do and what they don't do.
That is an excellent question, and that's the bottom line here. What is the PSA? What does it do? How do we use it? The PSA is a blood test that screens. And let's just take a look at the options here. We try not to use the PSA in a vacuum. In other words, taking a look at one isolated lab value for anything really does nobody any good. We have to look at that in context of that individual or that system that we've taken it from. So that, therefore, the PSA is coupled with a couple things. Let's just say this is your first time that you come in. We don't have any prior history. You come in with an elevated PSA. Well, then what we do is we sit down. First, we take a history and physical examination. We see if you're having any symptoms. We see if there's any family history. We see if there's anything that might be going on that might be causing this elevation, such as inflammation or other abnormalities. Then we finally, what we do is we do the digital rectal exam. We try to get an idea to see or to feel if the prostate's abnormal. We put that together. So let's just say that this is your first visit. You have an elevated PSA blood test. You have a normal, in you have a normal physical examination. In other words, we don't think that there's anything abnormal with your prostate. Then we have a couple options. We can go straight to prostate biopsy. We can say, gee, you have an elevated PSA. This might be a spurious result. There's if we can't find any other reason for it. And then I can say, well, why don't we come back in 6 weeks, 2 months, and repeat it, and we'll go from there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it will be a spurious result, and it will come down, and then what we'll do then is we'll just continue to track that. And again, this is where the conversation with the doctor comes into play. This is why we have to treat these things individually, because everybody has a different everybody's different. Everybody has a different expectation. Everybody has a different concern level. So you might come in and say, well, I'm really not concerned. I'll see you in 6 months, 3 to 6 months, doc. Great. That's fantastic. Or you might come in and you say, well, my brother's had it. I've had my father have it. Now I'm very concerned, and I think that I'd like to have this evaluated a little bit more immediately. So, yes, we have to look at all those things. We look at the individual, and we have to look at the clinical information and situation.
So if just a general question, typically as the prostate develops and enlarges, which is a fairly normal procedure or process, does the PSA tend to, the level PSA on any individual tend to rise sort of in correlation with that inflammation or enlargement of the prostate?
PSA tends to rise in level with the size of the prostate.
Yeah, okay.
It tends to. And again, we have to look at that, and that's why we also get that finger examination, so we can try to decide whether or not we think that that might be what is causing. However, over the years, with all the experience we've had in PSAs, and they've done studies and they've looked at these things, and they've factored these various things into account. So we have a couple things. We have absolute PSA levels that we like to keep people under, but then we have age-specific PSA. So I will allow, well, it's not me allowing, but the tables will allow
sure.
a guy who is 70 to have a higher PSA than a guy, say, who's 45 or 50.
Right.
So that's the age-specific PSA. But there's also something called PSA density, where we try to get the size of the prostate gland when we're doing ultrasound evaluation, and we get the density. That's not used as much anymore, but these are things that have been looked at in the past.
How about rate of change?
Rate of change is a very good point. And again, this is why we have to try to clarify when we're given these examples of what type of patient we have. Just say we have that patient who came in initially, he has no information. This was his first prostate cancer screen, and we decide to watch him over time. And what we will do is we will look at his PSA. If we decide to go to a yearly basis, for instance, what happens to that over time? Initially, or several years ago, and this is a constantly being updated with the more studies and more information we have, we did not want to see a rate of 0.75 nanogram per milliliter or higher per year. That has subsequently been reduced in certain centers such as Duke, and I do read the literature from both the national literature as well as some of the other more local literatures, but that has been reduced, I think, to 0.35, so it's been halved. So both our absolute and our rates as well as our age-specific have gone down. Used to be the cutoff was 4 nanogram per milliliter. Now it's 2.5 for the average. So these things are our moving target, and that's why we have to look over time, and that's why we believe in at least yearly follow-up and screening.
Well, I appreciate your time, and I will let you go for other callers, and thank you.
All right, thank you very much. That's
call.
A great question.
You know, what I'd like to just kind of maybe say to editorialize on a little bit, and then Dr. Allen, if you want to say something as well, is what there is no perfect test. I think there's often the thought that the tests are infallible. Any screening test is first designed not to miss anything, so we're often going to over-diagnose. We don't want to miss something, so they're designed not to miss anything. And then it has to be put into some frame of reference. And basically right now, PSA, along with a digital rectal exam, if I'm going to say this right, is the best screening procedure we can do. Nobody says it's perfect. Nobody says there's not a better thing, but we don't know of anything better to screen with for prostate cancer. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. And I'm sure you've been over this prior when you've talked about other things. But when a test – the test has to satisfy two things. It's sensitivity and specificity. The PSA test is very sensitive but not necessarily specific. So therefore, you can get an elevated result, and it doesn't absolutely mean that that's going to be predictive of prostate cancer.
For trauma or infection, for example.
Trauma, infection, or just, you know, some people just happen to have an elevated PSA that's natural for them.
Yeah.
But that coupled with those other things that we discussed, like the digital rectal examination, the monitoring of a trend over time, the family history, these are the things that we look at that may or may not trigger further evaluation.
Okay. Let me take a short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
The recorded rebroadcast of today's Line 1, Your Health Connection with Dr. Thad Woodard will repeat tonight at 8, and an archived copy will be available online at kska.org following today's live broadcast. KSKA is supported by listeners like you and Providence Alaska Medical Center. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of a stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. This is KSKA Anchorage.
This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking with Dr. Robert Allen, an Anchorage urologist, about prostate cancer. If you've got questions or comments about prostate cancer, there's a couple of ways you can get a hold of us, and we can answer your questions right now. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. Also a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org, and we will be available till just before 3 o'clock today. You can also listen later from 8 to 9 tonight, or at any time you can go to our website, kska.org/line1, and listen to this or previous podcasts. Dr. Allen, we were talking about aggressiveness a little bit before Rick's question about PSA testing. I can think of a way to put both of those issues together. Talk about aggressiveness. What do we mean by that? And what is one of the important issues about PSA that it relates to aggressiveness we might want to also understand?
Well, again, what we're doing is we're trying – let's just say that we have this individual who comes in, the hypothetical individual comes in with a – for screening or is referred because he's had a blood test that's elevated, and we'll just pick some numbers out of the air, okay? We have a 45-year-old guy who's got a family history of prostate cancer, and he has a PSA of 5. On the examination, I think he has a normal examination. So he and I discuss what it is that we think we need to do. He's concerned. I'm concerned. We elect to proceed in the next step, and this is – And there are other things we can do, but the most recognized next step would be to do a transrectal ultrasound of the prostate with prostate biopsy.
What's normal? Let's define what we would define as normal first.
The normal, first off, I don't feel any nodules on his prostate, on this guy's prostate, for instance.
And in a normal PSA level?
His is 5, and we're going to – for our discussion today, we're going to have the cutoff of 2.5. So okay. His is double what I would like to see.
Okay.
So then we go ahead and do the biopsy, and let me describe that briefly. I have a small biopsy probe that we insert into the rectum, same place we put the finger to do the examination. I put some numbing medication in there, not unlike what the dentist puts in your teeth or your mouth when he's doing his stuff. And we look at the prostate with the ultrasound. We look for any areas of abnormality. We measure the size of the prostate. And then we proceed with a systematic biopsy taking samples from representative parts of the prostate so that we pretty much have the prostate covered. For instance, if there is a clinically significant prostate cancer, we can say with some assurance that we have got that prostate cancer, sort of like looking for the needle in the haystack. So we've done that. The pathology comes back, and it shows that he's got a prostate cancer. So the first thing that I'm going to tell this individual, or the first thing I do when I look at the pathology report, I look straight to see how much of the prostate gland is involved. Is it one side, both sides? How many cores of different areas, or the percentage of the core? Is it a 5% of the and these are not unlike, I guess we'll use the mining analogy, when they do soil samples. We look at there's cores, and we look at the percentage that is involved with the cancer. But in addition to this, I look at the Gleason score. The Gleason score was devised by a pathologist, and basically what that does is it takes a look at the type of cells under the microscope. There, it goes from 1 to 5, 1 being less bad, 5 being more. We have a combination of Gleason scores because what they're doing is they're looking at the two most representative types of cancer. So if you have two different types, they're looking for the predominant types found on that biopsy. The most general one, or the most common one, is Gleason 3+3. That's moderate. Okay, so those are moderate. If we were to have a Gleason 3 or any 4 or 5 component, that might predict that it is a more of an aggressive prostate cancer. In other words, it looks worse under the microscope, and generally that correlates with what they do actually. We take this in combination with the PSA, and then we have an idea of how aggressive this might be. So, for instance, the higher the PSA, the higher the Gleason score, the more worried I am that this is more of an aggressive cancer. So let's just take this individual. He's got a Gleason, what did we decide, a 3+3? He's got a PSA of 5. So then what we do is that's moderate. It might not be as aggressive as other cancers. But then to take away some of the subjectivity of the decision-making process, we have what are called the Parton tables. These are tables that they've come up with that look at that factor of the PSA in with the Gleason score to try to predict, to give you a percentage of the possibility that this cancer is still confined to the prostate, whether it's gone outside the prostate, or what we can say statistically with some statistical confirmation that it is going to predict, to be predictive of what we think we have.
All right. So there's a complex variables that are used to try to help predict the aggressiveness or the need to operate. And one of the points that I think we ought to make sure people understand is that a PSA test alone, it does not do that. It doesn't answer that question of what's the risk of this being a very aggressive, and therefore we need to do something now.
And again,
it doesn't do that.
Right. What we do is the Parton table looks at the following. The clinical stage, whether or not you can feel something on the examination, the PSA blood score, and the Gleason score. That tells you what you might expect to find when you, as far as the severity of the diagnosis.
The corollary of that question is there's a lot of research undergoing right now trying to identify some perhaps marker that may help us predict. And the same thing is true of breast cancer and many other cancers is we're getting better at defining. And if we can define that better, then we may be more accurate in predicting, observing versus being aggressive.
There are other tests at certain reference labs and people are looking at, but right now – those aren't ready for prime time, and I think that the PSA does a pretty good job in conjunction with all those other variables.
All right. We've got a couple of emails and a call. I want to do some of this. Let's take this email. Someone writes in and says, does massaging the area of the prostate to promote good prostate health? I'm thinking of all them those bicycle riders out there. Is there any evidence that if you ride a bicycle a lot that you have better prostate health? I mean, that's not directly, but that's how I would think about this.
Well, there in the past, when we have had people who have been diagnosed with prostatitis and other pelvic pain syndromes that have ultimately been evaluated and found not to have a bad pathologic cause. And they have failed antibiotics. They have failed other oral-type medications. There have been some people who have been treated with prostate massage, and that has relieved their symptoms. But that is somewhat fallen out of favor more and more, because with the diagnosis, and again, this is an entirely different topic. Maybe we can talk about this other time, chronic prostatitis. Mm-hmm. We're not doing that as much anymore. But the point to be made there is there that can also elevate the PSA. So certainly you don't want to go to your doctor, have a prostate massage, and say, oh, gee, by the way, doctor, I don't have a recent PSA. Let's get one today. Yeah, you'd wait about a month for that.
Okay.
In addition, there have been some and you can find different studies saying different things, that you don't want to do a vigorous rectal examination prior to doing a PSA.
Yeah.
So what I generally tend to do in my practice is get the PSA blood test first, then do the digital rectal examination, so that we don't have that confounding variable in there that we might have influenced it.
The bottom line I'm hearing is that massage of the prostate has very little science to substantiate it. Is that fair?
I would have to say that's true. But then again, every individual is treated individually, so I don't want to say that's absolutely the case.
All right. Fair enough. Let's take one of our phone callers. We'll get Tech. Is Rex. You're on line one.
Yeah. I have been getting regular PSA exams, and the last one was rather elevated. And so instead of going to the urologist, we did a free and total test.
Correct.
And the free and total... Yeah, in the interim, I did some research, but the free and total score was like 17%, but in the meantime, the PSA dropped back to what had been kind of normal for me. So I'm kind of conflicted on the results.
Yeah, these are confounding things, and this is where and we do break the PSA down to free and total in those cases that we have an elevated PSA, but we don't have a cancer. And generally, I don't – in every – clinician uses this differently, but I tend to like to follow the free and total after I'm pretty much assured that an elevated PSA is not due to prostate cancer, because I've seen that test used in a fashion that I would not recommend, to give somebody a false sense of security by not doing a biopsy when in fact they probably should have undergone a biopsy. So yeah, these are the confounding factors. I mean, the PSA will rise and fall. You'll get a different result sometime, and this is why it needs to be looked at in the context of the examination and the values over time. So yeah, and sometimes when we can't come up with an answer, a biopsy might be, again, dependent, you get a vote in that decision to try to come to terms with all these different things that we can't figure out.
So the point here is the total is what really is important. This free and non-free is more information, maybe not as solid scientifically. It may not be – it's certainly not the screening test of choice.
And we used to look at we had held out hope previously that free and total PSA would help guide us better. And certainly – I don't think that's been the case, because we've seen it both ways.
Okay.
Now, there would be some people who say a free under 25% gives you a higher chance, but again, that needs to be looked at and discussed.
So Rex, for you, if I'm understanding things right, the good news is your PSA's gone back down, and then you have to put that in context with everything else, and don't use the free in total as the deciding point. Is that what you're saying?
I'd have to agree with that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. Peter, if you're there, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm an RN that does volunteer phlebotomy for the health fair, and we're getting a number of people in the 25 to 35 age range, having their PSA done.
Mm-hmm.
I always talk to them if they have a history or anybody in their family or any kind of symptoms, and almost universally the answer is no, and usually they don't really know what the PSA is. I was always taught that you normally started about 50 in African Americans. You might start it at 40, 45. Could you comment on that, please?
That's a very good point. That's where public education and medical education needs to come into play. A 25-year-old, a 35-year-old, probably not the best thing to do to get a PSA, unless, of course, for the 35-year-old, they have a severe family history. The recommendations from the American Urologic Association recommend that PSA screening start at 40 years of age. Now, there are other things that might cause you to modify that, such as family history, symptoms, but generally we say 40 years of age.
Okay. So I can safely tell them that they might consult with their physician, but normally they wouldn't need to start until age 40 unless they have some sort of specific family history.
Yeah, what they're going to do is you're going to start getting a lot of false positives. I mean, these are, you know, there's always going to be that, and that's one of the real details that go into selecting these cutoff times are, you know, is looking at factors like that. And there's, you know, you do enough tests, there's going to be a few that are high for
yes.
for multiple reasons that have nothing to do with cancer.
And again, this is for screening. Certainly, we can ask urologists, and we all have our anecdotal experience of the 25 and the 30-year-old who has prostate cancer. But generally, they have come in with other symptoms, they've been evaluated, and they've been worked up. And so I think that the value of a screen in somebody that age is not a good thing.
Right. Well, I usually have about 3 or 4 minutes to talk.
Of course you do, and thanks for volunteering.
How lucky
that's
you
a great,
are to have that
great service.
Yeah.
But and I have one other quick question regarding myself. I'll be 75 next month. Or in October, and my PSAs have always been below one, and I have good stream, don't get up at night, and I'm hearing talk about that at this age that it's hardly worth doing PSAs anymore.
Good question.
I would wholeheartedly disagree with that. 70 is the new 60, 80 is the new 70. We have a lot of vital people out there. There are those people who would say that it's probably not worth it. Well, you know, again, according to the American Urologic Association, this is a discussion that somebody should probably think about it. If there's a question, they should have it with their physician. What generally we like to do is have a life expectancy of at least 10 years. So those are other variables that go into it. You sound healthy if you have longevity in your family, if you're doing otherwise. And again, nobody can predict anything, but if we can sort of have a reasonable expectancy that we might make another 10 years, I think it's very important because even though you might not be the young guy, prostate cancer needs to be diagnosed and treated in those people who have it because, again, the aggressive nature of certain of these prostate cancers might cause you to have problems that you otherwise wouldn't have. And it doesn't mean that we treat all prostate cancers in all men. There are people we followed. And again, it depends upon the aggressiveness of the cancer.
Yeah, I understand. I used to be a urological surgical nurse way back in the dim distant past. And in those days, all we did was give, if they had an obstruction, they did a TUR and then started them on 5 milligrams of Stadistrol a day.
Yes, and we've come a long way since then. And But you're absolutely right. We don't treat it. I'm following a number of people, both at all age ranges that who I have diagnosed with prostate cancer. And we've elected – it's not that we're not treating them, but we're watching them. It's called, expectant management, watchful waiting. And we follow them. And if it looks like something's going to be getting out of hand, then we can decide on an intervention. But not everybody needs to immediately go to surgery or be treated in other fashions.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I'll get on.
And again, thank you for your time doing this.
Thanks for your call, Peter.
Right. Bye.
Let's take another short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Your You're listening to Line 1 on KSKA Anchorage. Tonight's edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection at 8 p.m. is recorded and is not accepting phone calls. Support for Line 1 comes from the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with a wheelchair on the sign. Children given positive attention and experiences during their early years are more likely to become smart, productive members of society. High-quality early education translates into higher graduation rates, better job readiness, and less crime and welfare dependence. So when you support a young child, you're supporting the economy. For more on early learning, visit bestbeginningsalaska.org. Early learning, it's everybody's business. This message comes to you from KSKA and Best Beginnings.
Hi, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. My guest today is Dr. Robert Allen, an anchored urologist, and we're talking about prostate cancer. If you've got questions or comments, you've got about 15 to 20 minutes to either call or email. You can call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us by email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Our previous caller was a gentleman named Peter who asked the question about whether at 75 with a very low PSA he should be tested or concerned anymore. It raises a little bit of a question, which I can provide a little bit more information about just to put this into some perspective. And that gets to this issue, which we haven't really talked about directly, is when and if you should treat. That's a slightly different question. But from the CDC reports, you got men in his lifetime has a 1 in 6 chance of being diagnosed with prostate cancer, but only a 1 in 33 chance of dying, implying that although prostate cancer is an extremely common form of cancer, it is not generally highly deadly. And those are all kinds of information that needs to be kept in mind. And again, I think what Dr. Allen is discussing here is the very important part of individualized therapy. Each person, each patient needs to be looking at their own life circumstances as well as their laboratory results and physical exam when trying to give them the best advice. And then, as he also pointed out before the program, that often that's done together nowadays, the patient and the physician getting as best information as we can and making the best individualized decision, which are guided by guidelines, but it's an individual decision. Bob, you were writing some things down. You want to comment on that?
Well, yes. Again, what I need – in the old days, we used to come up with a diagnosis, just like Peter said, and then we used to treat. Well, again, we have better data now. We have better tools to try to make that decision with the individual. My first job after I diagnose somebody is the most important thing after I have done the initial evaluation is try to educate the patient to what he has and what his treatment options are. There are several treatment modalities, and everybody has different expectations of their outcomes. The old days when people would be walking around in diapers and having these other things, I think those are through, but there are still people who are concerned about that, and that's why we like to individualize treatment. And there's a variety of treatment to include, just like I stated previously, making sure that it doesn't get out of hand and we can treat it later. So we have to sit down, educate, and talk. Education is the key.
Let's get into a slightly different topic. We've got an email that leads to a question about prevention, and it's always nice to know, is there anything we can do to prevent prostate cancer? And the question is, email that says, I'm on prophylactic finasteride. R is asking to comment on that. What is this? Why is he on it prophylactically? What does that mean?
Well, we always like to try to find things to prevent cancer, because if we can prevent it, then we can decrease all those bad things that are associated with it. There are several things that we try to do and that have been looked into to try to prevent it. First off, and again, the simple things. I was here previously, and I just need to reemphasize that a heart-healthy diet is is good for prostate cancer? Because generally, if you tend to look at things, if you don't have a heart healthy diet, you're more apt to die from a heart attack than you are to die from prostate cancer. So there's not much use in worrying about prostate cancer when you might have the heart attack. But let's talk specifically about that. There's a class of medication called 5-alpha reductase inhibitors that what they do and how they work is they work specifically on the prostate. They prevent the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone in the prostate. And it's that active form of testosterone in the prostate that causes two things: the prostate to get bigger, causing the symptoms of benign prostatic enlargement, but also it can cause prostate cancer. So what we had done in the past was to give these medications to prevent the prostate from getting bigger, which could lead to problems in the future, and this would prevent those problems from happening. For instance, if the prostate doesn't get bigger over time, you won't have symptoms, and then that can also keep you out of other treatments such as prostate resection for your symptoms. However, there are people who decided that, well, maybe this might work on prostate cancer as well. There have been two studies. One is the prostate cancer prevention trial, and I won't go into the design of the studies. I'll just say that as well as the reduction by dutrasteride prostate cancer events trial, both of these studies have shown with enough data to convince people that the American Urologic Association will now recommend. There's a recommendation now that these type of medications, finasteride, dutasteride, the trade names are Proscar and Avodart, when administered on a regular basis, might prevent prostate cancer with men in the future. And again, this is another one of those things where the individual has to talk to his physician, because it's not for everybody. It's generally for people who might be concerned. Now, do we know that this is going to be correct over time, and then somebody's going to say, well, how long do I have to take it? These are all variables that are still not answered yet. But the answer is yes. Now we have medications, the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, that we can confidently say can help reduce the risk of prostate cancer.
I'm going to take a caller shortly. What I do want to do is remind everybody that the free prostate screening done by Alaska Urological Associates begins the week of September 21st. You can find out times and places at a telephone number 276-1474, or go to Alaska Urology, or it's akurology.com. But it's the week of September 21st. There are several dates and times that you can have a PSA done and a digital rectal exam. Roger, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thank you. I'm interested in any comments you have on new developments in immunotherapy, like Provenge in April. The biotech company Dendrion announced robust results in their phase 3 trial. The question is two-part. I'm interested in your comments on Provenge and Dendrion. And also, it was a late-stage trial, and do you think that if the FDA approves Provenge first quarter of next year, do you see it being used in early-stage prostate cancer?
Again, these are trials that are not yet out mainstream. I think that you said that there was in phase 3 clinical trials. So they're still accruing and looking. Based upon that, I don't want to tell you my thoughts because I really don't think that we have enough information right now. Yes, it looks promising. And we have several things, and they're generally for people who have advanced prostate cancer that have not been cured by any of the other modalities, to include surgery and radiation. But
We've been watching this particular one because of a relative with prostate cancer out of state, and they did exceed what the FDA asked of them in their phase 3 trial. So it obviously doesn't have FDA approval yet because they're in the process.
And in fact, through our research arm at Alaska Urologic, our ACRC group, and Dr. Bill Clark runs that, he we are involved in several of these type studies, and I tell you what we might want to do is get him on so he can comment
talk
on those
about
studies.
Immunotherapy.
Yes.
So okay. Basically, put this in some perspective. What we're talking about is newer therapies. Often they're going to be offered to those with the greatest risk, these late-stage cancers, if they
right.
show effectiveness and are shown to be safe and effective. That's the job of the FDA, safe and effective. Then they may trickle down and be studied at different age groups. But at each point along the way, they have to be shown to be safe and effective. So a lot of these are still going to be down the road. For those individuals who might want to know more about trials like that, go to www.cancer.gov and look around for trials. And there's ways you can look into these kinds of things. But
am I still on by any chance?
Yep, you still are.
Regarding Provenge, it did get a 17-0 vote for safety from the FDA advisory panel. So that's why the big emphasis has been on, you know, will it prove to be efficacious? And their results were announced in April. So they're moving forward, and it looks like this could be a new wave in treatment of prostate cancer.
And certainly once these things come out of trials and are offered as mainline treatment, we still accrue data on those things, so things can change. And oftentimes we're offered another thing in our armamentarium or our toolbox of things to use for those people who need them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very
Thanks
much.
Thanks for your call, Roger. Yeah, Mike, you're on line one.
Thank you. I was diagnosed 15 years ago with prostate cancer during a TURP procedure. I've had many needle biopsies since then and many probes, and never have found anything more. Can you tell me my prognosis?
well,
other than survival.
And again, that was 15 years ago. So
yes,
with only that information and with the negative biopsies, I got to say it's probably pretty good. Now,
okay. This
you have what we call in the old days a stage A prostate cancer, and that was an incidental finding of prostate cancer found on transurethral resection of the prostate for prostatic symptoms. And that would be one of those exceptions, and we discussed the general place where the prostate cancer grows. That would be one of those prostate cancers that grew in the transitional zone. And
mm-hmm.
you might, and especially 15 years out, and if your PSA is stable and the biopsies have been negative, that was probably treated with the prostate resection. So that was a fortunate thing indeed.
Okay. One other question following up. My PSA has been at about 0.05 for as long as the resection has been, and then it's slightly elevated now from that, like up to 0.9. And then recently my doctor did the new test where you massage the prostate and then do the urine
right.
test. And that came out 422.
Okay.
Which is elevated. So he did another needle biopsy, and again, negative.
And I would be comforted with that the negative biopsy. And if you've been biopsied several times since then, that is all extra data that can tell us that you probably don't have a clinically significant prostate cancer.
Okay. Yeah, they've never found any more cancer other than that during the TURP. And there for a while I was doing it every 6 months with a needle biopsy and then once a year and then once every 3 years. And I was on a five-year cycle when my doctor did the massage test.
Yes. And again, like we discussed with your case and with every case, that's where you have to talk to your doctor because, you know, everybody has a different situation and there's different treatments and situations for everybody. And this just proves that illustration.
Yep. I talk to him all the time.
So. Yeah, that's
right.
A good thing.
Thanks for
yep.
your call, Mike. He's got an email. What's the best step other than regular checkups that a 55-year-old man can take to reduce his risk of aggressive prostate cancer if his PSA is not currently above 2.5? You have any suggestions there?
Well, again, it's just like we had discussed. I think that the best information to give people is a heart-healthy type diet, I think that yearly screening, certain things like if finasteride or dutasteride, you know, one of those medications might be a good thing. If somebody wants to do the utmost that they can do to prevent prostate cancer.
And Dennis, you're on line one. We've got about 2 minutes or so. What can we do for you? Dennis, you still there? His question appears to be one of what are side effects of biopsy or some question. Are there significant side effects of the biopsy that we need to mention?
That's a good question as well. The prostate biopsy is a frequently used tool, but there could be complications and risks to everything. What I counsel my patients is the following. The main risks of this are pain, bleeding, and infection. The way we take care of the pain is by numbing the prostate with the lidocaine-type medication prior to the biopsy. Bleeding, we ask people to be off any blood thinners or aspirin for at least a week prior. And infection is treated with the administration of antibiotics given before and after the biopsy. In spite of these things and in spite of great care, you will still get a certain percentage of those people who will have these side effects. However, we can minimize those greatly.
We went through a period in this country where we worried about the effects of vasectomy on prostate cancer risk. What's the current status?
Once again, you can find statistics to justify most anything, and that was also the case with the possibility of heart disease with vasectomy. Right now, that is not thought to be the case. In fact, there's a policy statement out by the American Urologic Association that would refute that.
So for us men, we need to – can't use that as a reason not to get a vasectomy.
That's correct.
Final comments. We got a minute or so. Any words of wisdom to leave us with?
Again, I think that nobody wants to get prostate cancer, but I think that in today's era with the advancements in treatments and the advance of knowledge regarding prostate cancer that this is a good time to be alive, putting it briefly. I think that it's very important that men get a yearly prostate screening and that you become not only a patient but a participant. And with new information technologies, with the internet, there are great sites that you can understand the whys and the wherefores and become and get a certain degree of sophistication so that you can be a participant in your care.
I've said this before. I think it was some great advice. The internet's a great place to go once you have a diagnosis. It's not a very good place
That's
to go
correct.
If you don't have your diagnosis.
It's good to go there beforehand. And what you want to try to do, and there's a plethora of internet sites, what you want to try to do is stick to the more recognized ones with reputation. University, American Urologic Association, American Cancer Society, all these type of things are probably the best places to go.
And again, if you want to know about the clinic that's coming up in the week of September, the number is 276-1474. Our thanks today to Dr. Robert Allen. I appreciate your taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Thad. I'm looking forward to next time.
Next week, we'll be discussing the Alaska Trauma Care Network. How are we doing compared to everybody else? We're going to be talking with Dr. Frank Sacco of the Alaska Native Medical Center and Reginald Barton of the who is he with? He was the American Surgical Association. So we'll see you next week. Have a good day.
This has been Line One, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.